This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, an excerpt from Prairie Pulse with Dr. Doug Griffin, the Chief Medical Officer at Sanford Health. But we are going to start today with Dr. Denise Lajmadeer. She is a writer, a poet, a jingle dress dancer, a birch bark biting artist, and a retired associate professor. She is from the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe, and today is Indigenous Peoples Day. Denise will be at an event this coming Wednesday at the Plains Art Museum as part of The Big Read. This is an event that will be bringing the first Native American poet laureate to North Dakota coming up in February. Joy Harjo will be at the Plains. This Wednesday, Denise will be there reading from her book, His Feathers Were Chains. It is her latest book of poetry. Denise, thanks so much for joining us today.
Bonjour, Amine. Good morning.
It is a beautiful book of poetry, and I have spoken with you before. I've read a couple of your books in the past. You are so incredibly skilled at writing painful subjects beautifully, and writing about beautiful subjects even more beautifully, I guess I should say. I'm wondering, when it comes to this book, His Feathers Were Chains, it's divided into different categories, kind of similar to how chapters work in books. Why did you want to put a book of poetry into different sections?
Oh, yeah. That is a question that all poets agonize over. I was reading, I think when I was trying to figure out which poems would go in which sections, and even the names of the sections.
Yeah.
I was reading, I think, Sylvia Plath or some other really famous authors that agonized over even what poems to put in and then about the sections. So I belong to a writer's group called OK Write there in Fargo. And we Zoom a lot now, of course. And I couldn't do it. I talked to my mentor, Larry Y. Woody. I said, I just can't, I don't know how to section off these poems. And he talked about some writer that he was visiting with in New York that said, I'd rather jump off of out of a window than try to section off my poems, really. So it is quite agonizing. So I had a friend, Jill Kandel, and she belonged to the writers group, and she actually read it, and she could organize them, and she organized them beautifully, something I just couldn't do. Mm-hmm. And so I've left the titles up to her for the sections, and then she put the poems in those sections, and I left it there and sent it off to the publisher, because I think she did an extraordinary job. So I needed help with that.
Well, you hear that sometimes when you go travel to a foreign country. People will often say it takes a foreigner's eyes for them to experience their own country. And so I think there's a little bit of a parallel there with writers. Sometimes you get that second set of eyes, and they're seeing things that you're not. The sections of the book are Broken Glass Dreams, Identity, His Feathers Were Chains, Thin White Heat, and Dancing with a Whirlwind. Denise Lajmadeer will be reading from this book this Wednesday at the Plains Art Museum. It is the kickoff event for The Big Read. Denise, I want to sample some of your work. Could you read His Feathers Were Chains?
Oh, absolutely. It's the title of the poem. I'll read it, and then I'll talk a little bit about it.
Yes.
His feathers were chains. At a small town in South Dakota, I stopped to rest and saw an Indian on a horse, welded together using farm implements and planted on the lawn next to the Sioux Motel. His war bonnet was a sickle bar, his shield a disc blade. His feathers were chains. A splicer connector formed his mouth into a permanent oval. His horse's body was a barrel, a harrow for a tail, his hoofs support brackets. I found him there and heard a war cry from his mouth like howls in my chest. Is one a warrior only when reveille is heard? Forgive me, friends, but he was there at Wounded Knee, Little Big Horn, Washita, Sand Creek, Whitestone Hill, and has a harrowing tale to tell. Staked to this earth, his feathers were chains, his blood a rusty red. So when I was driving around the country doing interviews with Native females for my dissertation, I stopped in this town. It was Murdo, South Dakota. So, of course, that's close to Pine Ridge Reservation and Rosebud Reservation. And saw this Indian statue welded together. So I actually had to, I sent a picture off to a farmer so that he could tell me what all these things were. But I got the title from his shield that was welded here. And the chains represented the eagle feathers that would have, you know, originally been on an actual shield. So then, you know, his mouth was that oval thing, I remember what that's called. But I thought he was a warrior, and he was probably there at all these horrible, I just imagined him there at all these terrible battles where Native people were killed. So that's how I come out with his feathers were chains, and that's what we decided to use as the title for the book.
Well, yeah, a line like that, his feathers were chains. Chains, of course, a symbol of oppression, which indigenous people have suffered under a colonizing culture for hundreds of years. And then feathers, something that gives flight, that allows the being to be able to leave that circumstance. The irony there of using chains to represent feathers. it's kind of thick.
I stood and just stared at this, and of course it was by the Sioux Motel, so that was and
right.
You know, I recently drove by there, well, a few years ago, and I stopped at the motel and he wasn't there anymore.
Mm.
And I asked the hotel manager what happened, and someone had ran into it with their vehicle. So it's not there any longer, which is kind of sad. But yeah, it was quite a remarkable find.
Mm.
And of course, as a poet, you see something like that, and you just, I went back to my vehicle and just had to write it down. And I love the title, His Feathers Were Chains.
Yeah.
That just came right away. Yeah.
Is that common for you, that you see something and you just immediately have to write about it, or sometimes do things simmer?
Well, yes, I carry a little notebook in my purse. So, yes. Recently, I was going on walks, and I'm trying to write my next children's story. So I actually have to use the the recorder on my phone. Because thoughts, when I'm walking, and my mentor, Larry Y. Woody, again said this, that a lot of writers are walkers or exercisers because it, you know, kicks loose the endorphins.
Mm-hmm.
So I was walking by Red Wing, Minnesota. I was there at a writer's retreat for a couple of weeks and walking along the Cannon River, a beautiful, quiet path. And things were just coming to me fast and furious. I got to put that in that chapter. Oh, that's going to be the name of this chapter. So I had to record, because what often happens by the time you get home after a 3-mile walk, you know, I forget. So I'm using my phone and then, of course, writing things down in my journal. And they turn into poems.
The Big Read event is happening this Wednesday at the Plains Art Museum. You will be reading from your poetry book, this most recent one called His Feathers Were Chains. In February, Joy Harjo will be coming to town. She is this country's first Native American poet laureate. What does her work mean to you?
Well, yeah, I've had all her books for years. She's Native. So when I first started writing, you know, I've been writing poetry since I was 10 years old. This would be back in the 60s. And I had no mentors in the 60s. And so in my mind, you know, I was a very shy gal. And I thought, well, I guess Indians just don't write. So how dare I think that I can write? And I've told this story many times. In 1984, finally, I saw a book by not only a Native and a female, but someone from my tribe. And that was Love Medicine by Louise Erdrich. She came here and did poetry workshops, and I shyly gave her all my poems that I've been putting on scraps of paper and envelopes and stuff like that. And she took me aside and said, Denise, you can write. So we did another 4 years of writing, and she wrote the introduction to my first book of poetry, Dragonfly Dance. So Joy, you know, Joy is in the same league, I guess, a poet, a native female poet. So it means a lot to me. And I do a summer workshop. We haven't had it for the last two summers because of the pandemic, but for middle school and high school students. And I want them to have mentors. Me as a mentor, I bring in other writers and other artists to show these kids that they can write and they can publish. I'm working on putting all their writing into a book that we will publish for them so that they can say they're published writers, you know, when they were in high school. So, you know, that's important to me, that they have Native representation, that, yes, we can do this. You know, unlike what I had in the 60s, there just wasn't anybody out there that I knew of or that my teachers knew of that could encourage me to keep writing. Yeah, I had really low self-esteem back then, but Louise and her sister, Hyde Erdrick, they helped nourish this book along, the Dragonfly Dance. So forever grateful for them.
And now Erdrick, of course, has won the Pulitzer Prize. Harjo is the U.S. Poet Laureate. These are both recognitions on a national level. So if you could comment on, you've talked about them on a personal level, but on a national level, this recognition for Indigenous people being in charge of the Indigenous stories here.
Well, again, it's I'm sure it's going to encourage Native writers all across the United States and encourage non-Native writers to to read their work and to experience, an Indian, a Native point of view. You know, I love Louise's work is often including, well, it's usually including Ojibwe people. She doesn't name specific tribes, but I'm so familiar with her work. It's like, oh, okay, she got that from here in Belcourt, from Mount Reservation, or from Red Lake. I know that.
Yeah.
So it just imbues such self-confidence and such a wonderful sense of pride that we have these two incredible women representing writers. Both, Joy has written another memoir, and Louise, all of her novels, her latest book, The Watchman, The Night Watchman. I knew her grandfather. I used to dance with him. Powwow was in the 60s here, in the 70s, so I knew him well. My mom was like a tribal historian. She had gone out to where they live, just over here a little ways, and interviewed him. So I had the interview that I had typed up that I was able to send to them, so that was pretty cool. So yeah, they Joy went to IAIA, down in where's that, New Mexico? Okay, I shouldn't have even brought that up. I forgot where it's at. But she went there, and you know, she was there. She's my age, and she was there. And I wish that I would have known about IAIA when I was in high school or just out of high school. I would have certainly went there.
And that's the Institute of American Indian Arts.
It's like a boarding school for writers and artists and you know, students that wanted to study in those areas. And but I was out in Portland. We had moved out there in the mid 1950s for relocation. So my teachers or my school counselors, they wouldn't have known about IAIA. So it's just a big missed opportunity for me. But that's where Joy started. She wanted to be an artist, I believe, but was introduced to poetry and so on. So sounds like it's still operating. It's a remarkable place for Native artists and writers.
Denise, you mentioned that you used to do a lot of dancing, and there will be jingle dress dancers at this event coming up on Wednesday. For people who aren't familiar, can you talk about the significance of the jingle dress?
Yes, I still dance. I haven't danced through the pandemic, and I was still too wary of COVID to dance, and even in the outdoor powwows this summer. But I still am a dancer. I've been dancing for over 50 years.
Wow.
So I started out as a fancy shawl dancer in the 70s, and then I moved into women's traditional with a fully beaded buckskin dress. And then in 1984, the jingle dress sort of took off across the United States. And it had been danced here in the Turtle Mountains, but it had died out. It had died out almost everywhere except for the Ojibwe people, like in Red Lake and White Earth and up in Canada. So there was some Jackson girls, there's four of them, that started going around to the powwows, and the sisters all danced jingle dress, and they just made it look so fun. Mm. I fell in love with it. So I started making, turning the cones, and I learned how from people, and started making dresses. I was given a dress at a powwow in Red Lake. Mm. And so I started dancing jingle. There is a ceremony that is usually goes along with it to teach us how to conduct ourselves as dancers. And I've never been to a ceremony, and I talk to people in Whitefish Bay, but I don't speak the language, so the language was important to that mm-hmm. ceremony. But they said to just do something, you know, to just honor that dress. We feast our dresses in the spring. And so there's a ceremony that goes along with that. And that, you know, so it was originally an Ojibwe dance. And there's a longer story about the healing dress. It's called a healing dress. And so I started dancing, and I've just been dancing ever since. I just absolutely love it. And the fact that it is a healing dress. And so it took off across the United States then. And so a lot of the girls have not really been told or counseled about the dress and the meaning of the dress.
Yeah.
So one of the big things is that we don't spin in circles, because then our life will be in circles. So I see watching the powwows on YouTube and so on, or the live powwows, I see a lot of the girls, you know, spinning in circles. Or so someone needs to, you know, counsel them. Hmm. But the dress is just a lovely story and a beautiful style of dance. So it became popular around. I started dancing in 1984, and now it's gone to every tribe in the United States. Just about every tribe, the girls are dancing jingle. So my poem, Identity Crisis, I guess, talks more about going into, you know, how I became a jingle dress dancer.
Yeah, I'd love to hear you read that.
All right. Identity Crisis. In fourth grade, the nun wanted to know what nationality I was. I asked, Mom, tell her you were Indian from the Turtle Mountains. I told the nun, she smiled hard, sucking in air. So you are an Indian from India. Yes. She brought me brass elephants and incense holders and books to write a report for the class. I can still see the B+. The kids believed me, called me squaw, jerked my braids. Woo-woo, stinking, savage, Indian. She has germs, tag, now you have her germs. In middle school, I was Chinese. In high school, Polynesian. Although I told the history teacher my father was Indian and attended the very boarding school she mentioned. So your father was a chief. All eyes shot towards me. I slowly nodded yes. The Portland Indian Center waved me in, and I was taken in by the American Indian movement. Indian power, fist pumps, marches, and demonstrations. Tied an eagle feather in my hair, wore beaded fringe that tipped and swayed. Bone chokers, soft soled moccasins, glared at white folks who dared to stare. One day I heard the drum at Delta Park, saw the butterfly dance. Calico dresses, winged arms spread wide, feet lightly touching the earth. I saw the owl dance and the war dance, white buckskin dressed men, regal. Time stood still as I watched the dancers, moccasin feet patting the earth. I couldn't breathe for the beauty. In the shadows of the teepee, I tried to capture the steps. The drum stopped. I overstepped. How did they know when to stop? My first dance outfit was a butter yellow wool flannel shawl, soft buckskin dress found in a reservation trading post, pink shell earrings, braids wrapped in fur, West Coast style, Apache moccasins copied from a Geronimo poster. Elders told me, listen to the drum. It is your heartbeat. The drum will tell you when to stop. I listened to the drum's heartbeat and danced. I danced the rabbit dance at Turtle Mountain, Crow Hop at Fort Yates, danced achingly beautiful 49er hand drum songs that brought out the northern lights over Newtown one warm August night, joined fancy shawl dancers at Fort Totten, then the jingle dress dancers at Red Lake gifted me a medicine dress, Dibaska Iganagude, and elders counseled me, you are Anishinaabe Ikwe. This is a healing dress. Dance zigzag to chase away all that is not good. Don't dance backwards or your life will be backwards. Tangle your jingles and your life will be tangled. Spin in circles and your life will spin in circles. I listened to the drum. I danced zigzag. I couldn't breathe for the beauty. I danced, I danced. I stopped on time. So that poem, you know, it talks a lot. It's a lot of my life in there, you know, growing up, moving to Portland and an urban area away from the reservation. So I was often the only Native student in all my classes all through high school. And my parents were boarding schooled, so they often didn't talk a whole lot about being Native or having, you know, their life on the reservation. So it wasn't until the 1970s. I knew I was Native, but what that meant culturally, the traditions, the ceremony, of course, their language had been beaten out of them at boarding school. They never spoke our tribal language again. So I didn't know who I was. So this is a poem about finding out who I was as a Native person. And the American Indian Movement in the 1970s was a big part of that. And I went to 2 years at Portland State University. And then as soon as I could, I packed up and came back to the reservation to do my junior and senior year at UND in the Northern Plains Indian Teacher Corps program. We had come home during the summer, so I knew my cousins and my grandparents. And I would beg my parents to let me stay here on the reservation with my cousins. And because I think they were boarding school, they didn't want to separate us kids or be apart from us, so they would never allow that. But as soon as I was able to, I was 19 or 20 when I was able to hop on that train and come back and have never left, you know, just very happy here. So it's been a long journey, you know, learning spiritually and the ceremonies. I'm still taking language classes as old as I am, still learning. So I wanted to pass that on as a teacher to a Native student so that they feel proud of who they are as a Native person and not, you know, go through the hell that I went through as a little girl and the only Native person in all of these classes. So, yeah, so that's a lot is put into that poem.
Denise Lajmadeer will be reading from her book, His Feathers Were Chains, this Wednesday at the Plains Art Museum. It is the kickoff event for the Big Read. Coming up in February, our nation's first Native American poet laureate, Joy Harjo, will be coming to the Plains Art Museum as well. Again, that's coming up in February. And there are a number of events in between Wednesday's kickoff and February's event. And you can find out more on the Spirit Room's website. Denise, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Still to come on Main Street, we share a profile of one of the inductees to this year's North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor and a Prairie Pulse excerpt with the chief medical officer at Sanford. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Despite this year's extensive drought, North Dakota soybean growers are, on the whole, happy with this year's crop.
With some rain and some maybe better than expected yields, the bar was pretty low. People had low expectations. That has made people feel a little better about the whole situation.
North Dakota Soybean Growers Association Executive Director Nancy Johnson says while yields are lower because of the dry weather, it hasn't diminished any optimism.
It's been a tricky year to contract because it's been very, very difficult to forecast kind of what your yield is going to be. But for people that have contracted, there have been some excellent prices during the summer. And prices right now, if you were just to deliver them at the elevator today, are above what they were certainly last year at this time. So that is optimistic. But again, most people have significantly less bushels than they had last year, too.
North Dakota growers planted 7.25 million acres of soybeans this year, a level that surpassed the number of acres dedicated to spring wheat. The director of the State Department of Human Services Economic Assistance Division says it's too early to tell if the demand for the low-income home energy assistance program will be stronger this year because of higher natural gas prices. Michelle G. says the program began accepting applications October 1st.
Obviously, the weather's been pretty nice up to this point. Our program utilization fluctuates based on the weather. So as the temperatures get cooler, we'll likely see an increase in our utilization.
G says the state has not yet received its final allocation of LIHEAP dollars from the federal government, but she says she expects it will be about the same as last year, $21 million.
The program can also assist with furnace cleanings, repair and replacements, and weatherization services. So the LIHEAP program, we partner with the Department of Commerce, who provides those services on behalf of the LIHEAP program.
Last year, the program served about 12,800 households in North Dakota. G says there are income limits, and you can find those on the website, nd.gov/DHS/services/financial-help/energy-assist. And John Smith, known as the Flying Farmer, known for his aerial car jumps, is recovering after what he calls a bad ride. 2 weeks ago, the Makoti, North Dakota man was seriously injured when his car went off a ramp trying to for a distance jump of 200 feet in a challenge with his son. Despite serious injuries, three surgeries so far and another surgery scheduled this week resulting from the crash, he's not about to give up his daredevil act.
Oh, no, I'm not giving up. I'll be doing it again. My wife said she'll leave me if I do it again, but she's been with me for 34 years. She won't leave.
Smith says he didn't have his car lined up properly and should have dodged the ramp to avoid the corkscrew crash, but he said he had good speed and didn't want to lose the challenge. About 300 spectators were watching when Smith crashed his car on September 25th. Rescuers had to use the jaws of life to get him out of the mangled car, and he was taken by medical helicopter to a Minot hospital. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. A touchstone energy cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
Liz had found the love of her life, but there was a hitch. Her friends didn't believe he existed.
She said, "I believe that Sergio is who he says he is, and I'm not interested in what someone else thinks."
How our desires can overpower reality and keep us from seeing the world clearly, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And on this Indigenous Peoples Day, we share a profile of one of this year's inductees to the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor, Dave Dauphiné. He was inducted this year alongside Lydia Sage Chase of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation and Sitting Bull of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Dauphiné is of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. Mokoche Studios of Bismarck has made videos for each of these inductees. And in the profile today of David, we hear from Richard Marcellet, a Vietnam veteran and Turtle Mountain tribal member, Lance Azur, an Army veteran and tribal member, Carol Davis, a boarding school classmate of David's, Nelson Ray Mackey, who served with David in Vietnam, Dwayne Gourneau, an Army veteran and tribal member, and of course, we hear from David himself.
We see him as a hero here in the Turtle Mountains, but he doesn't feel like he's a hero. When you talk to him, he's just another soldier. He'll tell you the heroes were left in Vietnam, and we had 5 of those here in the Turtle Mountains. So he would tell you those 5 individuals would be heroes to him.
And we didn't know that. I mean, there's a guy, you see him at the mail every day, and not knowing that he's a war hero. 3 Bronze Stars and 1 Silver Star.
It really surprised me when I learned what a hero he was. I had never heard his military story. And then in the newspaper one day, there was this article, and I almost thought I was reading about somebody else, because here they were talking about what he had done, and people were saying after that article that he really should have gotten the Congressional Medal of Honor.
I think he well deserves that. And I think people should know what it means and not just as a Silver Star and have no idea what it is. It's not a everyday occurrence that you can get one of them and still be walking away. He kept people from getting hurt and saved lives of several people.
All my boys, I take pride in every man that was under me, my command, as a section chief, made it out alive.
Dave was a leader, and he would watch out for his fellow soldiers, especially the ones that came to Vietnam, the new recruits, so to speak.
See, when I first went over there, it just happened. We had some green troops. Most of us were green. They were scared. But I had lived a different kind of life. I went to boarding schools, so I was on my own, so quite a bit. So I took charge right away because I knew I had to. Otherwise, I'd have been killed or something. So it didn't take me long to make sergeants, a couple of months.
In the last couple of years, I found out a lot about him and, you know, what role he played in the Vietnam War. He was talking with my wife, and he said, you know, I almost went to jail.
Oh, I was arrested for 5 minutes.
Police showed up, and they tried to arrest me, he said, because I was evading the draft.
One morning, I heard a knock on the door, and I looked out, and I seen two suits out there, and I thought they were after Leonard Peltier, because...
He said, when did I get drafted?
And he cuffed me up. You're a draft dodger. Well, I ain't no draft dodger, he said.
They said, we've been sending letters to... Well, his mother had kept the letters, but he's working in another state.
She said, damn letters. She I tore them all up.
Of course, then things worked out. He went into the military and became a hero, so... That's what I do know.
He didn't want me to go, but I went.
I went over to his home, and he's a very humble man. I asked about his war experience, and very humbly, he started talking a bit about it.
Yeah, we got a mortar and rocket attack one night. That's what they do before they ground attack us. We fought all night. And I woke up in the morning. I don't know how this happened. See, your adrenaline kicks in and you do things spontaneous, I'd say. You lose track of time. Like, you do things and you don't remember. In the morning, I was full of blood. Can't remember how that happened. So the next morning, I looked up. And the generals came down and congratulated us and all that. We made it through.
Now, we can never forget these veterans, all of them.
I think he's an example of bravery, respect, trust. All the seven teachings of the Ojibwe you could find in David, because he risked his life. How many of us are called on to risk our lives? Not many. And if we were called on it, would we do what David did? Dave is also a family man. Got a wonderful wife, Marlene. They do things together. They have this family relationship, like this good family unit.
I honor him for his services that he gave to the United States of America and Vietnam in all of his activities and achievements that he accomplished while he was in Vietnam with the Silver Star and the three bronze medals. It's not every soldier that gets those honors.
We had some good time, but not too many. So it was a year in hell, but I came, made it out without a scratch. That was it.
Welcome home, Dave, and we're glad you're here. Welcome home, brother.
That was the audio from a profile of Dave Dauphiné, who is of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa and one of this year's North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor inductees. It was produced by Mokoche Studios of Bismarck. Coming up next, a Prairie Pulse excerpt.
MSUM's Cheryl Nelson Lawsett Performing Arts Series presents Ragamala Dance at 7:30 p.m. and an all-ages workshop on the culture of southeastern India at 1 p.m. on Saturday, October 16th. Both events will be held at the Roland Dill Center for the Arts on the MSUM campus. More information is available at mnstate.edu/perform.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are going to check in on what it's like to be in a hospital and what the latest advice is, given that it is still an ongoing pandemic. Here's an excerpt from last week's Prairie Pulse television show with John Harris as he visits with Dr. Doug Griffin, the Chief Medical Officer at Sanford Health.
Dr. Griffin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Well, unfortunately, COVID's been in the news for way too long. I wish we could finally get rid of it. But, you know, we now have sort of a new player in the long-running COVID saga called the Delta variant. Can you talk about where this originated and how infectious is it?
Yeah. The Delta variant was first identified in India. It's basically a mutation, and this happens to all viruses, mutate and form new variants. It is a more infectious variant, you know, probably 2 to 5 times more infectious than some of the previous variants that were predominant.
Really? Okay. Well, can you talk a little bit about the difference of how it attacks maybe an unvaccinated person versus a vaccinated person?
Yeah, really, it attacks in the same way. It's more about how an unvaccinated person's body responds and a vaccinated person's body responds. So the virus, you know, gets in. We think it's largely airborne transmission. So breathe in, gets in through the mouth or nose and into the lungs, and then begins to start its infectious process. In a vaccinated person, they recognize this as a foreign substance, and they already have antibodies and an immune system geared up to respond to and fight it off. And an unvaccinated person, it's new to them, and so they don't have that head start with the immune system primed, and they're more susceptible than to actually become ill.
Can you discuss maybe the current bed situation? You've been in the news this week talking about that, and tell us about the situation at Sanford, and then are the majority of these people unvaccinated or vaccinated?
A couple of things in there. First of all, the vast majority, about 90% or close to 90% of our patients hospitalized with COVID are unvaccinated. And that's really the trend across the country, that the unvaccinated are much more likely to become ill enough to need hospitalization or pass away from it. That's just one thing contributing to the bed situation. We've been very full for the last several weeks with patients of all types. And the other thing that's been increasingly challenging this time around is we are really struggling even more so with staff. Staff are tired. Staff have left healthcare. They have left and gone to work in other parts of the country for travel organizations. It's been a very disruptive market. And you've seen the cries for staff for basically all employers around that. So that's part of the challenges as well. So that's as big a challenge as the physical space.
Is there any scare or threat of not having enough workers?
Absolutely. We are far from fully staffed. I'm not sure when or if we'll ever get back to fully staffed in all sorts of components of healthcare. And we're vastly having to change how we deliver care, extending people, finding new ways to do it. So it's a reality. It's here, and we're very concerned about it.
Can you explain or talk about the vaccine hesitancy, and is it frustrating to you? And yeah, can you talk about that?
Hugely frustrating. I'll say that right off the bat, and I'm not the only person. Vaccine hesitancy. You know, my work as a family doctor for many years, I had many conversations, usually with parents of children hesitant to get their children vaccinated, and some adults hesitant for vaccines as well. It's really gone to a different level here now, and I think there's become a political component to it, and some other components as well. So it is very frustrating. I'm not sure I have an explanation for it entirely, but it's a big problem, actually.
And for people that are vaccinated, can they just go back to business as usual, or should they still be careful and, you know, use hand sanitizer and things like that?
Yes, they still need to be careful, and you know, unfortunately, it's not. I can say that if we had had a better uptake in vaccine, we would be closer to being back to normal or back to normal. That's our barrier getting there. What the vaccine does is it does offer you very, very good protection from needing to be hospitalized or passing away from COVID. So the vaccine, somebody once described, and I thought this was a pretty good description of the vaccine. So if you have an umbrella or a raincoat and you're going out in a light rain or even a fairly steady rain, it will keep you dry for the most part. If you're going out into a drenching thunderstorm or a monsoon, it's going to leak through in some places, and you'll get a little wet or damp, even though you have a raincoat or an umbrella with you. Same thing with the vaccine. When the level of virus is very high, like it is now in our communities, it's not going to protect you 100%. So you still need to use those precautions: social distancing, masking in indoor public places, and washing hands. So,
you know, are there any breakthrough cases, and how many are we seeing statistically, maybe? And, you know, sort of when you do see them, how sick do people actually get?
Yeah, in general, yes, there are breakthrough cases. I was just looking right now in this country, about 189 million people have been fully vaccinated for COVID. In that, however, just 21,000 have needed to be hospitalized. That's about 1 in 10,000, if I had done my math right. You're about 30 times more likely, so still not super likely to need to be in the hospital if you're not vaccinated, but it's 30 times more likely that you'll end up in the hospital. And it's even more likely, it's a greater difference on dying than if you're unvaccinated. So we are seeing this is largely a pandemic right now driven by unvaccinated people.
Has there been any increase in vaccinations because of the Delta variant?
Yeah, I think there has. We're seeing that in our state, and I think in other states that increase Delta variant cases or cases in general, I think has driven more people to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Of course, everybody has the right to make a choice, but what's sort of your answer to why to get vaccinated?
Yeah, I think this is different. The vaccine is a public health measure. So if you choose not to take the vaccine, you're making a choice for everybody else as well, because you're putting everybody else's health at risk as well, too, because you can very well transmit it, continue to propagate this. It's different than making a choice if you should have a heart surgery or take a blood pressure medication. It's different than that. So I agree that there is some personal component to it, but I think there's a personal responsibility to help everybody else in the community.
What about the vaccine for ages 5 through 11? When will that be readily available?
Yeah, it's being reviewed right now by the FDA this month. We're eagerly awaiting. What I hear is perhaps towards the end of October, we'll have an emergency use authorization for the Johnson & Johnson for that 5 to 11 age group. So,
mm-hmm. Now, there are some people already getting a booster. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, who's recommended to get a booster, and maybe who does not need it?
Yeah, good question. Another thing that can be a little bit confusing for things. First of all, a third dose or a booster is recommended for immunocompromised people for both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines. Just recently, for the Pfizer vaccine, the CDC has recommended that boosters be given to those 65 or older. Those patients that are in that 18 to 65 age group with underlying health conditions, of which there are several that they define, and people at high risk for occupational exposure. That would be healthcare workers, people that work in congregate living settings, perhaps teachers as well, too, so several groups. So it's a large portion, and that's for the Pfizer vaccine only, still waiting for more direction for Moderna and J&J on that.
Okay, so, but that will be coming also, you believe?
I anticipate that it will be. Both have applied, and their data is being looked at now as well.
Can you talk a little bit about a big issue has been masking, the balancing school, about how they're doing that, and whether you're on a plane, whether you're in school, talk about the masking recommendations.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I know, because the CDC, initially when you were fully vaccinated, you could go without a mask. And then now with the large transmission, it's been recommended to wear masks in indoor public spaces, regardless of whether you're vaccinated. First of all, I have great respect for our school districts and public educators and private educators and our school board members, and I have great sympathy for the difficulty in decisions. However, I do think the science is really quite clear, and I, as a person of science, my recommendation, and I commend the districts that have done this, is that all students and staff should be masked in school at this point in time, based on recommendations from CDC, American Academy of Pediatrics, our own public health. I think it's not necessarily popular with a lot of parents and families. But I think that's the right thing to do. And several schools have chosen that route.
Well, I read in the news that Los Angeles was talking about a strict mask mandate about going in a bar, a gym, a nail salon, or even a Lakers game, that you have to be fully vaccinated. But how would you even police that? I know it's not your job, but...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a variety of things that are being developed by different state governments to identify. I mean, we identify people of age to serve alcohol in a bar. You need to present your driver's license or something to get on a plane. I think there are probably ways to operationalize it. I don't know exactly how it is, but in a large city like Los Angeles, a big undertaking, I agree.
Well, we talked about herd immunity back a year ago and wanting to reach herd immunity. Is that still an issue, or are we aspiring to that still? Or?
Yeah, as I talked to some of the infectious disease folks that are far smarter on this than I am, is that may not be something that we attain. What we may be dealing with was a disease that's endemic, and our best chance, like the influenza, and our best chance would be more to control it. So I'm not sure that's totally out of the realm, but the longer we go at this point in time, I think the more likely we're dealing with something that's going to be with us for a long, long time, and we'll just learn to live with it in many ways.
All right. Well, Dr. Irvin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
That was Prairie Pulse host John Harris visiting with Dr. Doug Griffin, Chief Medical Officer at Sanford Health. You can watch that whole episode on our YouTube channel. Coming up this Thursday for Prairie Pulse, Harris visits with North Dakota State Representative Ruth Buffalo. That's Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hey, lifelong learner. Humanities North Dakota is featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eli Saslow, author of Rising Out of Hatred. This event will explore the rise of white nationalism and political polarization in contemporary America and point toward overcoming divisions and hatred. Information and registration can be found at humanitiesnd.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 11th. When the Salk polio vaccine rolled out in North Dakota in 1955, children ages 5 to 9 and pregnant women were given top priority. Parents welcomed the vaccine with open arms. Polio could paralyze and even kill, and young children were the most vulnerable. The National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which led the March of Dimes for vaccine research and patient care, provided the vaccine free of charge for first and second graders. Salk's vaccine came in a series of three shots. By the end of 1955, 59% of those children in North Dakota were vaccinated. None contracted polio. On this date, in 1955, North Dakota's health department expanded the age group of people eligible for the vaccinations. Everyone 19 and younger could get the shots. The federal government provided $134,000 to North Dakota for these vaccinations. The expanded eligibility was thought to encourage parents to bring in all of their children at one time to be vaccinated. More than 23,000 shots were given that October and November. But due to a vaccine shortage, only one-third of eligible people had had their first vaccination 8 months after polio shots began in the state. Health officials discontinued a third round of shots so they could allocate more vaccine for the first and second shots. Nevertheless, the end of polio had begun. Cases dropped dramatically year after year. An oral polio vaccine developed by Dr. Albert Sabin replaced Salk's shot in 1962, and by 1965, North Dakotans had stomped out polio, with the exception of at least two cases in the 1970s. In 1975, the legislature passed a school immunization law to address several diseases, including polio. The law came after decades of disease outbreaks among children amid lax vaccination rates. As low as 46% of students were fully vaccinated for polio. The health department wanted at least 90% vaccinated to prevent diseases from reemerging. The bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Aloha Eagles of Fargo, said, "In my generation, we all immunized our babies without a second thought, because we were only too much aware of the horrors of the polio epidemics. But most of today's young parents know nothing about those outbreaks and the human tragedies they caused." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
A former Afghan interpreter and his family recover from their harrowing experience during the final days of the U.S. military presence. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Gichigami Hearts, Stories and Histories from Mesabi Kong. We visit with author Linda Lagarde Grover. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.